It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Well, there were so many great players that that came before you down there. A lot of them you mentioned. We've talked about Bobby Locke and Gary and, you know, Nick Price, kind of a transplant, Ernie Els, Retief. You know, some of the more contemporary guys, I guess, Schwartzel and Neusthazen. You had a guy down there, Timmy Clark, that you competed with, I know. Tim spent a summer at our club in Chicago right after he finished his 2 years of school and right before he was ready to go play pro. And I got to play with him a few times that summer. I just remember on a par 72 watching him, and it's probably the best player I'd really seen up close and personal over an extended time frame. He shot 65 like it was nothing.
Yeah. Mega talented.
And made everything he looked at.
Yeah, I just spoke to him last week, actually. So talented. He is about 3 years older than me. And so when I was coming into the junior ranks, he and Rory Sabatini were the two superstars at that time. And Timmy has, you know, amazing hands. Like his control of the club face and his ability to put the sweet spot on the ball really is one of the best that I've seen. And he's a bit of a throwback, really, the way he would play and the way he would hit shots and the feel that he had to be able to create these shots. You know, I sort of think at times that he was caught in the wrong era. You know, in the advent of this Pro V1 coming out and golf ball technology is really taking a big step and sizes of driver heads getting bigger and bigger. That did not do any good for him at all.
Yeah, he would have had more of an edge in the era of wooden heads and spinny balls.
100%, because he was able to really put that, know where the sweet spot on the club face was at all times. And, you know, so you couple that and link all of that with the injuries that he struggled with, being born with his wrists fused.
Right, yeah.
His game, his swing, his body was just built for accuracy and not necessarily for power. So,
yeah,
he ran into you know, bad timing from an equipment standpoint, but a wonderful, wonderful player. And had, you know, when you, it's one of those names that, you know, it, you can forget about as the years pass, but every now and then when his name comes up and people pay attention and they go and look at the record books, you know, unbelievable player, President's Cup, Players Championship, you know, way up there on career money earnings. And so, yeah, fantastic player.
Yeah. So how old were you when you started thinking, hey, you know what, I'm pretty good at this. I want to try and compete and see how good I can get at this game.
Well, when I started, I told my parents I wanted to be a pro golfer. Like, there was nothing else that was ever on my mind. You know, I didn't want to be a fireman or a teacher or a pilot. It was just from the first day that I played golf, I told my parents, this is what I want to do. And thankfully, they believed me and they did whatever they could, stretched themselves extremely thin, time-wise, financially, to enable me to try and have as best opportunity as I could. So very thankful for that. But it was about 12 or 13, I would say, when really it started to become apparent that I was just a little bit different. And was winning tournaments, local tournaments, junior tournaments. Won my first senior amateur event when I was 13. Won the South African amateur, I'm wanting to say, when I was 16. And so it all happened quite quick in a 3 or 4 year span of time there, where I got a little pop of distance as my body was maturing and I was becoming a teenager. and I was able to match the short game that I had with a little bit of distance and a lot of fire and determination. Mm-hmm. And really from that moment on was when it became really serious, mm-hmm. and started to compete over here in the States and then eventually in British amateurs and stuff like that. So I would say probably from about the age of 12 was when it was apparent that, you know, I had an opportunity to play pro one day, probably.
So it was 1993. Was that the year you came over to play in the World Juniors? Was that the first year that you'd made that long trek to the United States to play golf?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Played in the 13-14 division.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember now. I think I lost in a playoff that tournament as well, or finished in the top three. And then that got me to another tournament later that year that was in Japan, where they got a bunch of juniors from around the world to play together, and I won that one. And so wins like that were starting to happen, and I was just so focused, so determined, one-track minded. You know, everything was just about golf, improving, consuming as much of the sport as I could, whether it be watching every minute that I could when PGA Tour events or majors were on TV in South Africa, which is, you know, in the middle of the night because of the time change.
Right.
To the point to where my dad built a chipping and putting green in our front yard. And, you know, so that I could practice on days when I couldn't get to the golf course, or, you know, come home from the golf course and do an extra 15 minutes putting work. Mm. And then that wasn't enough. So then we put a floodlight over the green so that I could practice at nighttime.
Oh, boy.
Like, it's ridiculous when you start to remember stuff like that. But I was obsessed. Obsessed, absolutely obsessed. And, you know, when you speak to my school friends from that time now, you know, they'll all tell you that I was just crazy. Like, there was nothing else, nothing else on my mind. Whenever they were going to parties on a Friday night or whatever, I would be practicing or getting ready for the tournament the next day, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was the only thing that I cared about and paid attention to.
You should compare notes with Amy Alcott sometime, if you haven't already, with her front yard golf course with the with the soup cans in the ground to putt into, and she put nets up over all the windows on the front of the house so she wouldn't break any windows.
Yeah. Look, I broke a few, and thankfully we had wonderful neighbors. You know, it got to the point to where just chipping and putting around the green wasn't enough. Next thing, I was taking it, you know, 100, 150 yards away and hitting 9 irons over four houses and
right.
stuff. Couldn't see the green. And, you know, every now and then you'd hear the ball clatter into a roof or something like that. And I'd be taking big divots out of our neighbor's grass. But they all, you know, they all just went along with it and understood that, oh, it's that golfer. He's pretty good. You know, maybe he'll be a pro one day. And so they all just humored me.
Yeah.
And allowed me to come onto their property and start whacking golf balls around the neighborhood. And it's interesting when you think about, you know, you mentioned Amy Alcott. I know Phil Mickelson had a chipping green in his backyard. Ernie Els had a chipping green in his backyard. You know, there's a number of players through the years that you read those stories about where they were so in love with the sport that their parents found a way to encourage them.
Yeah. You mentioned winning the South African Amateur. That was in 1997. Is it Humewood Golf Club?
That's it. It's one of our only links courses in South Africa.
Over David Somervale, 2-1, and you were then, I think, the medalist the next year in the event as well.
Yeah, that's right. It was a wonderful time for me. So now I'm between like 16 and 18 years old. I'm, you know, making the national team. That South African amateur win over David He was from New Zealand, actually. And all the top New Zealand amateurs were over for that South African amateur, because right after that, the South Africans were going to pick a test team, is the words we would use. So four players, and we were going to go play a test match against New Zealand's best four players. And so, yeah, it turned out that David and I played against each other in the final. And then we both went on to play in the test match the next week. So it was a great time for me, you know, to be traveling around all over South Africa and occasionally outside of South Africa to go play like the Eisenhower and different things like that. We went to Chile to play that. We went to Argentina to play some test matches. And it was great because you get to – you know, when you're at that point, all you want to do is compete and prove how good you are, and prove that you're good enough. Really, it's not necessarily how good you are, but it's that you're good enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I remember even around and about that time, 97, playing in the amateur for the first time, and going over to the UK and playing links golf for the first time. And going down to St. George's, which Bruce, you know well, and just being blown away by how you're having to mold your game and hit different shots and deal with the conditions and the wind pumping off the ocean and getting weird bounces and being stuck in these pot bunkers. And just it feels like you're learning a whole new sport. And even then, though, it's like, okay, this is a little different. This is different to the type of golf that I'm used to playing back in South Africa. But, you know, I also think I'm pretty good. And so I want to show these guys that I'm pretty good. Yeah. And found my way to get to the final that year as well. So, like I say, it's just it's wanting to prove yourself at all these different levels that makes that time so much fun. And really allows you to hone your skills mentally and physically and emotionally for that day when you eventually do turn pro, because you know that's when it really counts, that's when it really matters. Mm-hmm. That's when the pressure really ratchets up, because now this is how you're going to feed yourself is by getting a little white ball into a hole as few times as possible. And so those experiences where you have a little bit of adversity and you're needing to fight to prove yourself really do serve you well in years to come.
So prior to you turning pro in 1999 at the age of 19, you won the U.S. Amateur Publinks Championship. You beat a professional by the name of Jason Duffner. You'll remember that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. That was a big deal. You know, I really wanted to – one of my goals was to play in the Masters as an amateur, and that really was why I wanted to go play the amateur at St. George's, and that was that carrot that was dangling in front of me all week, and why I was, you know, so distraught and upset when I eventually lost in the final. And at the time, my brother, a few years prior, had finished playing collegiate golf in Columbus, Georgia, and we had joined a club, a public club in Columbus called Bull Creek. And so we were members there, and that was what allowed me to be able to play in the public links.
Ah.
And it was at Torrey Pines. I knew the area well, having played Junior World there, and actually went back and stayed with the host family that I always used to stay with when I played Junior World.
Isn't that amazing?
Simon's family, who lived out at La Costa, which is another place you'd know well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of fun. My parents came over and they got to meet the Simon's family and, you know, thank them in person for looking after me for all the years when I would come over and play. Mm-hmm. And managed to work my way through the tournament and, yeah, run into Jason Duffner in the final. We had a long delay because the marine layer rolled in and we had about a 3-hour delay before we could tee off. but eventually got going. And that was really the icing on the cake for me for my amateur career, was winning that tournament, winning a USGA event, getting that invite to the Masters, and then being able to have that awesome experience in 99.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, made the cut, finished 56th, I think, in that first Masters in 1999.
Yeah, it was just such a special week. I actually have a picture of it up on the wall back over there. Was amazing. I was in Orlando the week before working on my game. Went up to Augusta. Practice rounds were just a dream. You know, played with Ernie one of the days. I played with Gary Player one of the days. Played with Jesper Parnevik one of the days. Played with Greg Norman and Nick Price in the par 3 tournament. It was just spectacular. After the practice round on Tuesday with Gary, which eventually became our tradition, him and I would play together every Tuesday at 9 a.m. at the Masters. And that particular day, after we finished, I'm just this, you know, young kid, and he's invited me up into the champions' locker room to have lunch with him. And we go up there, and Sam Snead is up there, and he's holding court, and he's sitting with us telling stories. And I was just the teenager with, you know, eyes the size of plates, taking all of this in, looking around, feeling like, you know, how on earth have I found myself in this situation, in this room with these legends? And eventually the draw comes out. It was the first year, there were a couple of firsts in 99. It was the first year they went to groupings instead of pairings on the first 2 days. So we played in threes. And I got drawn with Gary Player and Steve Stricker.
Oh, my.
And it was also the first year that a second cut was introduced. So first time that they'd had a longer cut or, we're at CBS, we don't say that there's no rough. There's no such thing as rough at Augusta National. So it's called the second cut. But that was the first time that that was introduced. And so there was a couple of firsts. I got up and down on the 18th hole to a front right hole location for par on Friday. And I was on the bubble. At times during the afternoon, it didn't look so good. And we were obviously all glued to the TV to see if I could make the cut. And you know, I've never told Tom Watson this. One day I'm going to, probably. But I've never told him this story. Actually, I don't think I've told anybody this story. This might be the first time. But Tom Watson, the reason I made the cut was because Tom Watson, back right hole location at 16, we all know how tough that is. It's a tiny piece of green, the size of a mid-sized rental car that you've got to try and keep.
That's
the ball
about right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, 9 times out of 10, you pitch it half the way up the bank, it rolls into the lower
down
level.
Down the bottom.
You smash a 40-footer up the hill, two-putt, and move to 17, or try not to three-putt.
If you can, if you can.
That's right, try not to three-putt. But Tom Watson made the one mistake you can't make. And he missed it in the right bunker. And it's so difficult from there. A lot of time that bunker holds a bit more moisture. And so, you know, when that happens, the ball comes out a little flatter. He couldn't keep the bunker shot on that top level, rolled down to the bottom, and then he three-putted. So he made a double bogey, 5 at the par 3. And he was the player that allowed my score to get into the weekend. So, you know, I apologize, but I may or may not have cheered while he made the double bogey on
16. I'm going to play this clip the next time we meet with Tom, Bruce.
I was just a naive 18-year-old wanting to play the weekend at the Masters. And lo and behold, make the cut. Huge thrill for all of us. The family had made the trip over. And the third day got drawn with with Vijay Singh, and so was able to watch him. That's 99. Yeah. In 2000, he wins the Masters. Mm-hmm. You know, so many crazy little things happened, but what an amazing week that was, getting to meet some of your heroes like Payne Stewart and Vijay and Sam Snead and players like that.
Yeah, pretty fancy.
For a young kid that grew up in Somerset West, South Africa, it sure was a treat.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Of course, we're going to come back to Augusta National in a few years, but before we do, let's just cap off some of your amateur accomplishments before we get to turning pro. And one thing to talk about would be competing 30 years, actually 40 years after Bruce first competed in the Eisenhower Trophy. You competed in the 1998 edition, as you mentioned, in Chile, and that had to be a fun experience as well.
That was wonderful. It's wonderful because, you know, anytime you get to represent your country, it's a thrill. And so for us to go over there and compete with the best in the world in the amateur ranks at that time really was amazing. We didn't play all that well. You know, I'm wanting to say that the Australians won that year.
GB and I.
Was it GB and
I? Aussies were second, so GB and I had a guy named Luke Donald on their team.
Mm-hmm. Is that right? Now tell me, was Gary Wolstenholme on that team as well back at in those times?
With the GB and I guys?
Yeah.
He sure was.
Yeah, he's a legendary amateur golfer.
Yeah.
Over there. Okay, I remember the Aussies being up there because, you know, as always, the Aussies and the South Africans and the New Zealanders, we generally all congregate and hang out together. And those boys were playing well, and so we were rooting them on. We were not having our best time, but still, it was great to be able to go down there. The thing that really jumps out to me about that week is, so now, what year was that? Was that 98 or 99?
98,
yeah.
98, okay. Mm-hmm. So leading up to that time, from really 95 to 98, I was spending a lot of time in America playing junior golf, working on my game, and you know, here in Orlando at a place called Lake Nona.
Sure.
The reason for that is because that was where Ernie lived at the time. Mm-hmm. And so Ernie now at this point had heard about me and seen me come through the ranks, and we were starting to play a little golf together. He was starting to win majors, won the US Open in 94, 97. I'm able to spend time with him in Orlando, practice with him, learn from him. And because of him, I met another resident of Lake Nona whose name is Jim Courier, the tennis player.
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we get down to play the Eisenhower in Chile. And we're sitting at breakfast, and I look across the breakfast room, and there's Jim Courier.
They got a tennis tournament.
Yes, he's playing a tennis tournament there. So I go up to him. We start chatting. He's like, oh, I'm playing a tournament here. What are you guys doing? Oh, we're playing a golf tournament. And he's like, well, do you want to come watch the tennis? I'm like, absolutely. So he leaves tickets for us at the tennis, and our whole South African team went to go watch him compete in the tennis tournament that he was playing that week. And so that was something that was unexpected.
Yeah.
And for, you know, the other three South African guys, my teammates that were with us, I'm sure they didn't think they were going to be able to watch Jim Courier play in a tennis tournament, sitting in his family box and cheering him on. So that was a lot of fun. And you know, you mentioned a couple names there, Luke Donald. I know Brett Rumford was there for the Aussies. I know Sergio Garcia was there for the Spanish team. And so a lot of similar names start to weave their way through between that time and turning pro and then all of us playing on tour together.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron Baddeley, of course, was playing for the Aussies. There was another Aussie, Kim Felton, who was actually the medalist.
Yeah, brilliant golfer. I played a lot of golf with him. Fantastic player, and he competed well in the amateur ranks and actually played well in the Aussie Open and Aussie PGA a couple times as an amateur too. but never quite realized his potential once he turned pro. There was another incredible Aussie player. Adam Scott and I talk about this all the time. David Gleeson was the guy's name, mm-hmm. an Aussie who was out of this world style golfer. You know, Baddeley was another one. Obviously, he won the Aussie Open as an amateur, mm-hmm. and then the following year as a professional. So he was doing stuff that was remarkable and Tiger Woods-like, really. Yeah. But this kid, David Gleeson, he was special. Yeah. Played a little bit on the European Tour eventually and in the Asian Tour and Japanese Tour for a while, but never made it over here. But, yeah, a lot of great players.
So the Aussie on your screen there played in the inaugural Eisenhower Trophy matches at the Old Course in 1958.
Oh, what a thrill that must have been.
Yeah, that was great. You're right, what a thrill. Yeah, we were fortunate enough to beat the Americans by a couple of shots. Yeah. Mike always remembers that another gentleman that you know was there with me in those days, Bob Charles. Charles.
That's right.
The Open winner at 1963. Yeah, it was fun. And then that next year is the year I went to South Africa for the Commonwealth Games representing Australia. We played in Johannesburg, and I was the individual stroke player there at that tournament. And then in 1962, we went to Marion for the Eisenhower Cup matches. So. Yeah, the amateur golf playing for your country was really quite special.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. It's there's an emotional feel good vibe. It sort of warms your heart when you have the opportunity to represent your country and mm-hmm. and you know, hear the anthems and.
Yeah,
and stuff like that. It really is something you remember and something that is very, very special.
Bruce and Bob Charles were also in the audience one evening that week when the honorary captain for the U.S. side, Bobby Jones, was awarded the Freedom of the Berg, given the keys to the city, the second American ever after Benjamin Franklin. And there's been only three now because Jack Nicklaus got it a few years ago, and made that famous speech that Ben Crenshaw mm-hmm. actually recited for us, didn't he, on our podcast with
Ben
him.
Crenshaw can recite the speech that Bobby Jones made that night, word for word.
Yeah. You were in the audience that day.
Oh, yeah, I was there when they helped him stand up out of his wheelchair and he thanked the St. Andrews for the honor. And then, of course, like I said, like Mike said, he was the captain of the American team. So we got photographs with all those great players. It was quite an experience for a little boy from Australia.
Yeah. No kidding. I was fortunate enough just this last summer to take my son and daughter for the first time to St. Andrews. And, you know, it's kind of like a religious experience, really, mm-hmm. to be able to go there and spend time there. And, you know, they have an appreciation for what this sport has meant for our family and the fact that it really everything we have is because of the sport.
Yeah.
So to be able to go to the home of golf and get a feel for the history and the monuments and go to the ruins and walk through all the different pubs and restaurants that all these legends have been through and into. It was such a thrill for us to go and spend 3 days there after the Scottish Open this year. It was just tremendous.
So we're going to get you turning professional, but before we do, the path you took to get there is certainly not a 2023 path. So let's have Trevor Immelman be, sort of 19 years old again in 2023. You think that path might have looked a little different for you?
I do. I was actually talking to somebody about this just a few days ago when we were talking about the fact that my son is now going to go and join the golf team at Clemson. And, you know, this particular reporter was asking me about that time in my life, same way you guys are, and the schools that I was being recruited by, and the decision-making process to be able to come over here and study and play some more competitive golf as an amateur or turn professional. And I told this guy, this gentleman, that, you know, when I look back at it now, it gives me a bit of a cold shiver, really, because, you know, when you're that age and you think you're pretty good and you've won a fair amount, you don't really ever see the negative side of anything.
That's right.
You think, oh, well, this is perfect. I'm pretty good. I think I'm good enough. I'm going to turn pro. Everything's just going to be roses and sunshine and lollipops. And you never quite think to yourself, well, what happens if it doesn't work out that way? Yeah. And really, maybe that ignorance is a good thing. But now when I look back at it at age 43, about to be 44, I sure am thankful that things turned out the way they did. And particularly in my case where, you know, by the end of 2008, when I'd started struggling with some pretty bad injuries, you know, if that had happened a few years prior,
yeah, different
who
story.
Knows what would have happened. So that's why I say I get a little bit of a cold shiver now when I think of my confidence and my naivety at the time. But shortly after that, you know, I'm extremely grateful and thankful that it turned out the way it did. But for me, I was being recruited. But going back to what we were talking about earlier, I was so single-minded, and I didn't want having to study and having to pursue an academic career. In my mind at the time, as ridiculous as what it sounds now, in my mind at the time, having to invest in studying and pursuing an academic career as well as playing golf, all it was going to do was take away from me getting better
playing
at
golf.
And so I couldn't wrap that around my brain at the time. And so it was a pretty short conversation. And we were approached by a management agency, my dad was, and decided to turn pro, and they handled the running of that, and that was it. I got going, and it was a rocky start, and I didn't have success immediately, but I slowly but surely started working my way through the ranks.
So are you saying you didn't have a plan B?
No plan B
or C.
That's the thing that is so so funny, really, is I've never ever had a plan B, but somehow this wonderful game has just put me in the right place at the right time, and I've experienced it again now.
Yeah.
With my second career and doing the broadcasting, that was never ever ever on my radar. And, you know, just a few years ago, I decided to jump into it. And here we are all of a sudden, you know, I'm the lead analyst for CBS. And so that wasn't a plan either. But somehow this sport has just always looked after me.
It's kind of worked out, yeah. Well, you know, I ask about different paths you might have taken today, of course. And I've probably heard you say this as well, that today's university system prepares these young players so well now.
It does.
For what they're going to face competitively on the tour, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. The you know, I think in general, coaching has gotten better in every aspect because of technologies as well, and people just being able to really measure and really know, rather than know through experience, and in a lot of cases, that experience can be some old wives' tales that have been handed down through generations and generations of how people learnt and what helped them to play well. But now there's so many different ways to measure what your body is doing, what your equipment is doing, what the ball is doing through the air, that these players get better so much faster, and they can own their own swing so much faster.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure Bruce will agree with me on this. You know, when I turned pro, it was sort of like an unwritten rule that, you know, you've got to pay your dues. You've got to be out here for 2, 3, 5 years learning the ropes. You've got to learn how to travel. You've got to learn where to stay. You've got to learn the golf courses. You've got to learn which caddies to get and not get.
Yeah.
You've got to know where to get your yardage books, how to play this hole, which greens are faster than the rest, all these different things. But now, you know, these players fast track all of this stuff, and they come out ready, and they compete in such a fierce way in the amateur ranks and in at the collegiate level. And with the advent of PGA Tour U and the coverage that these men and women golfers get on Golf Channel, and they're learning how to deal with the media and being on TV and all those kinds of things, the step is just not as big as what it once was. Now, you know, once in a generation, we would see somebody like Tiger or like Sergio or like Jack. But now you pretty much get one in every class. You know, and we've just experienced it with Ludwig Aberg.
Yeah. How about that?
It's just incredible. You know, 2 years ago, nobody really knew much about him. He starts to find his way on tour. You start to hear whispers about this kid out of Texas Tech and that he's the best driver of the ball in the world. And he's not even a pro yet. And you sort of scratch your head and wonder, because every week I'm watching Rory McIlroy and Victor Hovland, and I'm like, how can anybody possibly drive it better than those two,
right?
And here this guy comes out, and the first tournament he plays on the PGA Tour, he leads strokes gained off the tee.
Yeah,
amazing. And I'm like, what? And this guy hits the ball, and I swear to you, it has less than 3 feet of curve every single time with the driver.
Yeah.
It's spectacular.
Yeah.
And, you know, he owns his swing. There's no getting onto tour and tweaking things and changing things and, oh, I need to learn how to hit a high long iron so that I can hold the green on long par fours and par five. They have it all when they get to the tour now.
Yeah. And that I'm sure that makes your new job in some regards more enjoyable, but also more challenging, because you're having to learn these new players coming along at an accelerating rate.
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt about it, Mike. And I was actually having this conversation with Tony Romo just a few weeks ago, who's my counterpart in the NFL for CBS. And, you know, we've both experienced that as you get into broadcasting, just like you say, you know everybody's traits and ball flights and demeanor and the things that make them good, their strengths and their weaknesses. But as you start to get the changeover, you now have to learn about a whole new group of players.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of studying. But, you know, for me, I'm thankful that I love the game. I love being in tune with it. I love constantly being plugged into what's going on. Even this last weekend, you know, I make sure that I catch some of the golf. I watched the last 9 holes of Bermuda. I saw my buddy Camillo get across the line, which is just a very, very special story after what him and Maria have been through over the last few years. And so you just stay plugged in all the time. Look, I don't do it all by myself. I've got an incredible researcher, Josh Pick, who keeps his ear to the ground at all times as well. And so him and I are sharing thoughts and ideas throughout the season, even when we're not working, just trying to make sure that we know exactly what's going on, and so that I'm ready when CBS kicks off their golf season in 24.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.